This message on the book of 1 Thessalonians is made available through the teaching ministry of High Peaks Bible Fellowship. It is our prayer that God will guide and enrich your study of His Word. And now we begin this lesson on 1 Thessalonians.
What I'd like to do today as we begin talking about Paul's letters to the Thessalonians is spend not so much time in the Thessalonian letters as spending time in the book of Acts to kind of get an idea of what happened during Paul's second missionary journey. The last time that we spoke about kind of what Paul was up to was we talked about his first missionary journey. You'll remember as we talked about the introduction to the book of Galatians, how we saw that he left the church at Antioch and he went over to the island of Cyprus. And then they sailed north to a little seaport. And from there, they went by land north to a city called Antioch in the region of Pisidia. And then they went over to the Lycaonian cities of Lystra, and Derbe. And then they retraced their steps, went back to the coastline, and sailed home. In the book of Acts, chapter 13 and 14, talk about Paul's first missionary trip. And at the end of Acts chapter 14, it talks about his return. It says that they returned to Antioch, and in verse 28, it says they spent a long time with the disciples. And you might have in your Bible, penciled in margin there, the word Galatians. Because that is probably where the Apostle Paul wrote the book of Galatians. Some people from Galatia came to him in Antioch and told him about the situation there and how the Judaizing teachers were trying to get them to be circumcised and obey the law of Moses. So he wrote the book of Galatians, the letter to the Galatians, and sent that back with them to clear that up. But look what happened in chapter 15 of Acts. Some men came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And in verse 2 it says, And when Paul and Barnabas had great discussion and debate with them, I imagine that they had great discussion and debate with them, because Paul had just finished writing the letter to the Galatians dealing with the exact same issue. So the brethren determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders concerning this issue. And that is when we see in Acts chapter 15 the great first church council at Jerusalem. They had to discuss this issue of whether or not the Gentiles needed to be circumcised and obey the law of Moses.
So you'll see in your notes on our chart here, the first thing we have here is A.D. 41 to 54. Claudius is the emperor of Rome. Now, we don't see that in the scriptures here, do we? But from secular history sources, we know that during that time period, Claudius was the emperor of Rome. And you'll notice that that's quite a long time period. That's a time period of 13 or 14 years that he was the emperor of Rome. And if you notice the other dates in our chronology, all of those dates, all the way down these columns, are encompassed within Claudius is the emperor of Rome. It may not seem important at the moment, but it's going to be important when we get into talking about certain things that Paul wrote in the first letter to the Thessalonians. Because Claudius was an interesting character. The emperor before him was a guy named Caligula. Caligula was assassinated. And that left a leadership vacuum in the Roman Empire. They didn't know who was going to be the emperor. There wasn't a direct heir apparent that was an obvious choice. The people that had the most power at that time in Rome was the Praetorian Guard, the palace guard in Rome. And so some people actually think it was almost like as a joke that the Praetorian Guard grabbed a guy named Claudius and made him the emperor. You see, Claudius was the uncle of Caligula. But he was the least likely person to pick as an emperor. He was physically handicapped, but he was not mentally handicapped. Because he was part of the royal family, and because he was physically handicapped and not considered to be a threat for power, he spent most of his time in study. He read history, philosophy, and so he was one of the most brilliant minds of the time. But he was the least likely guy to be considered an emperor. The Praetorian Guard grabbed him and made him the emperor of Rome. And in his first year or two, he actually proved to be a fairly decent emperor. He was considered an essayist and a writer. So he had a lot of interesting background. He wasn't just your typical general on the front lines that decided to, you know, take Rome and become the emperor. When it says Claudius is emperor of Rome, that's the guy who is the emperor of Rome. And that will come into play here fairly soon when we start looking at what the letters to the Thessalonians say. Because he was kind of paranoid. There was a lot going on within his 13 or 14 years of leadership that would threaten his ability to keep the throne. He didn't want to be assassinated like his nephew had been. So one of the first things he did was he had his nephew's assassins killed. The senators who had conspired with them to assassinate Caligula, he spared their lives. And so they were indebted to him. So the Senate was kind of on his side then. It's an interesting time period, and there are a lot of interesting things that happened. But he was kind of paranoid because there were some things going on, kind of political intrigue within the court at Rome. I mean, he was afraid he could be assassinated and replaced at any time. He had to ensure that that did not happen. And so anything suspicious that went on, he took care of it. He quelled it as quickly as he could. He also was married three times. So it was kind of like a soap opera. And one of the things that happened was his third wife conspired with a nobleman to assassinate him. And he found out about the plot and had the happy couple killed. So there were things like that were going on in the palace. And he was very aware and kind of attuned to that kind of thing. Also, just in the empire was large. And in the empire, there were different people groups who had caused problems. One of them was the Jews. Right around the reign of Claudius, the Jews had one of those cycles of rebellion. And they kind of cycled in and out of rebellion for a couple hundred years, really, around the time of Christ. And they went into one of their rebellion cycles. But he was very, very much aware of that and would not want any rebellion among the Jews. In fact, there are several interesting inscriptions that have been found during this time period, actual letters from Claudius saying, "The Alexandrians may not invite the Jews from Syria down to Alexandria," because he was afraid that they would create rebellion down there. Now, who were the Jews from Syria? Well, it would have included the area of Judea, but it also could have been Christian Jews who were wanting to establish churches. And as we've seen, even in our brief talk about the first missionary journey of Paul, as soon as Paul went into these Jewish cities, what happened? Some believed, but the ones who didn't believe, at one point they dragged him out of the city and stoned him, right? And left him for dead. Another point, they caused riots, and the city officials got involved. So it seemed like everywhere that the gospel went, it was going to the Jew first, but the Jews who did not believe would raise a stink about it. So that was a common thing that was going on. We saw then on our chart here, after the line that says Claudius is emperor of Rome, we saw Paul's first missionary journey to Galatia, which was the region down here. We saw that. And that's discussed in Acts chapters 13 and 14. And we know that he wrote the letter to the Galatian churches probably around 48 AD. And he was sitting in Antioch when he wrote that letter. So in AD 49, we saw the Council of Jerusalem in Acts chapter 15, which is where we are here. And then another event that I was kind of leading up to here on your chart, it shows in AD 49, Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome for troublemaking. In fact, one of the historians of the time recorded it by saying that the Jews in Rome were to leave, and it was on account of a rebellion or a disturbance that had arisen over a person named Crestus. Well, that sounds very similar to Christos, which is the Greek word for Messiah. It could very well be that there was an occasion where Jews who had come to hear the gospel when they were in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 2, remember the incident where the flaming tongues came down and Peter preached an amazing sermon, and Jews from all over the empire really came to know Christ. Well, what did they do after they had come to Jerusalem, heard the message, they were celebrating the feast? They went home. Some of them were from Rome. It's very possible that the gospel had been preached in Rome very early on in church history. And it's very possible that something like we saw happening to Paul happened in Rome around AD 48-49. And it caused Claudius, the paranoid, to say, all of you Jews, you're no longer welcome in Rome. But later on, we'll also notice that two of the influential Jews who left Rome at that time was a husband and wife named Priscilla and Aquila. And where did they go? They went to Corinth. And later, Paul is going to meet them in Corinth. So this whole, all these pieces are starting to fit together here. We see on our chart that AD 49 and 50 was Paul's second missionary journey through Asia Minor to Macedonia and Achaia. And that's talked about in Acts chapters 16 and 17. So let's take a look at Acts chapters 16 and 17 here. We notice that at the end of Acts chapter 15, when the Jerusalem Council was over and they produced that great letter that did not require the Gentiles to be circumcised and obey the law of Moses, in verse 30 it said they were sent away and they went down to Antioch. So Paul and his companions that had gone to Jerusalem went back to Antioch to their home church. And having gathered the congregation together, they delivered the letter. I bet they were thrilled to be able to go back and deliver that letter. Because remember, in Acts chapter 15, verses 1 and 2, there had been all that debate about the circumcision question. So they went back with the letter and they delivered the letter and said, here is the decision. We were correct. You do not have to be circumcised. You do not have to obey the law of Moses. And when they had read it, they rejoiced because of its encouragement. Why would they be so happy about it? Well, in Antioch, remember, the church was mainly composed of Gentiles. They were very happy to have been saved by grace through faith in Christ. Verse 32 of chapter 15 says, and Judas and Silas, also being prophets themselves, encouraged and strengthened the brethren with a lengthy message. And after they had spent time there, they were sent away from the brethren in peace to those who had sent them out. But Paul and Barnabas stayed in Antioch. So the group, the fellowship, you might say, like the Fellowship of the Ring, a timely illustration of the movie, the Fellowship of the Ring that went down to Jerusalem to get this matter cleared up came back to Antioch. But then the fellowship broke up. Paul and Barnabas stayed in Antioch, and they were teaching and preaching with many others also the word of the Lord. Verse 36 says, and after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, now, after some days could be quite some period of time, couldn't it? It's a time when Paul and Barnabas had a great teaching ministry in the church in Antioch. So after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brethren in every city in which we proclaimed the word of the Lord and see how they are." Well, what cities would those have been? The cities of his first missionary journey, which would have been all the cities along here, especially in the southern part of Asia Minor. They wanted to go back to Derbe and Lystra and Iconium and Antioch and visit the brethren there that they had seen before. And Barnabas was desirous of taking John, called Mark, along with them. Well, we know what happened, don't we, from the first missionary journey. John Mark had gone as far as Cyprus, and he had sailed up to the seaport in Asia Minor, but then what happened? Paul considered that he had deserted them on the mission field. And Paul didn't like that. It says in verse 37, "And Barnabas was desirous of taking John, called Mark, along with them, but Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along, who had deserted them in Pamphylia, and had not gone with them to the work." So Paul was very insistent. Verse 39, "And there arose such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another. And Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus." So Mark got to go on a mission trip with his relative, Barnabas, and they went back to Cyprus. Well, that was where they had established some churches and made some converts too, wasn't it? So one missionary team went down and visited those churches. The other missionary team, however, was Paul. Paul chose Silas, who was one of the guys that had been in the fellowship that went down to Jerusalem. Paul chose Silas and departed, being committed by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. And he was traveling through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Well, that's a different direction. They didn't just sail over to Perga and go back and retrace their steps, did they? In fact, they went the opposite direction. If you notice, over here is where we see Antioch. It's down along the coast, the upper right-hand corner of the Mediterranean, over here. So Barnabas and Mark went by sea to Cyprus, but Paul and Silas went by land. And they traveled up through Syria and into Cilicia. Cilicia was the area where Paul's hometown was located. So they went by land around the upper right-hand corner of the Mediterranean and crossed into the region from the backside. You didn't have to come by sea to get to this area. There was another way. There was a back door. In fact, there was a really interesting area they had to go through. It's called the Cilician Gates. It was this mountainous, very treacherous rock formation that was sheer cliffs on each side going up hundreds of feet with a path through them. And they had to go through the Cilician Gates to get into this area. It was a place well known for bandits and robbers because it was easy to get trapped there. So they went the back way, you might say, through the Cilician Gates into the area of Galatia from the east. And it says in chapter 16, "And he came also to Derbe and to Lystra." These are the last cities that he had visited before on his first journey. The last place, it was as far as he got, was Derbe and Lystra. So now they're the first cities that he comes to. And also we know that the cities of Lystra and Derbe were known for a fellowship that included a guy named Timothy. Chapter 16 here talks about Paul hooking up with Timothy again and the good report that Timothy had among the people in that area, among the Christians there, and how in verse 3 it says Paul wanted this man to go with him. So Paul wanted Timothy to join the fellowship he was creating now as he went on his missionary journey here. What they did is they... In verse 4, "Now while they were passing through the cities, they were delivering the decrees which had been decided upon by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem." Well, what was that? That was the letter, wasn't it? That great letter from the Jerusalem council that told them, no, they did not have to be circumcised. So here was the final word on the question. the final decision had been made, because this decree from the apostles at Jerusalem solved the issue once and for all. So I bet Paul was thrilled to go back to these churches that he had written earlier and say, look, here's the final decree from Jerusalem itself. You do not have to be circumcised and follow the law of Moses. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and were increasing in number daily. This is church growth happening right here in Galatia. In verse 6 it says, and they passed through the Phrygian and Galatian region. And this is interesting. In verse 6, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. If you look at where they were here, they had gone through Lystra and Derbe and Iconium, and they've gone back over here to Antioch of Pisidia. And that was right on the edge between Galatia in the green and Asia in the orange or yellow. It was right on the borderline. They were sitting here in Antioch, and they were trying to decide where to go next. And they knew that Asia would have taken them this way. All of these wonderful, great cities in the province of Asia could be evangelized. Would that be a good thing? Absolutely. It would be a great thing for Paul to take the gospel to Asia. But God said no. Isn't that interesting? Even if something is a good thing or a very positive thing, sometimes God might answer your prayer by saying no. And you would say, but God, this is such a great thing. There's so many benefits if we go down here. The most populated and well-known and sophisticated cities in the whole area are down here. Please, let us go to Asia and preach the gospel. And God said no. Just because something is a good thing from our perspective, or even from God's perspective, that doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do at the moment. And knowing about chapter 16, verse 6, might help sometime in your life. When you get to a point where you're thinking that you really want to do something that seems like a good thing, and God is not allowing it to happen. So just keep in mind that here Paul sits, right here in the middle of Asia Minor, with everything here to the west of him being wonderful territory for evangelism. To the east, there's not a lot of places, you know, big major cities that he can go. It's not as much of a populated area. It's more rugged, mountainous area in the center of what's now Turkey. And here he sits in Antioch, wondering what to do next. Well, he says, we can't go west. The Holy Spirit says no. So let's just keep going north for a while. Let's go north and see where we end up. So they go north. It says here in verse 7, and when they had come to Mysia, they were trying to go into Bithynia. Well, where is Mysia? Mysia is in the northern region right along here, at the top of the area called Asia Minor. They got up as far as Mysia, and they wanted to go into Bithynia. Where's Bithynia? It's the purple area right up here. Bithynia and Pontus was an important area along the Black Sea. Now that might be another place where it would be good to take the gospel. So they got up here to the north, and they were just about to go into Bithynia. And what happened? The Spirit of Jesus did not permit them. Isn't that interesting? Even though it would have been a wonderful thing to take the gospel to the east into Bithynia, the Spirit of Jesus did not permit them. Where did they have to go then? Well, they followed the northern border here of Mysia until they got to a town on the coastline right here called Troas. And it says, and passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas. Something very important is going to happen in Troas that affects why Paul wrote the Thessalonian letters. Okay? Verse 9, and a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A certain man of Macedonia was standing and appealing to him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. Where is Macedonia? Paul was probably thinking, God, we've got all this territory to evangelize here. God says no. So he moves this way. He says, God, look, we've got all this territory to evangelize here. God says no. So Paul's content to leave it with the Lord, and he ends up on a point of land. He can't walk any further without putting his feet in the water. And that's where God, by direct revelation, tells him which direction to go next. He probably had not thought of going way over here into Macedonia. Macedonia is this orange area clear across the Aegean Sea from where he was. But a man from Macedonia was calling out to him, saying, come over and help us. This is God saying yes to the Apostle Paul. Paul says, where do you want me to go, God? And God says, I'll tell you exactly where I want you. I want you to go clear over here. Not down here, not up here. I want you to go clear over here. Now is the time to be in Macedonia. Isn't the sovereignty of God amazing? His timing is phenomenal. Now, was Asia important to God? Yes, because later he's going to have Paul spend a lot of time in Asia, but not now. Not the right time. So God says, go to Macedonia. And when he had seen the vision, immediately, verse 10, we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. Therefore, putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace, and on the day following, to Neapolis. Samothrace is this island right here. And Neapolis is the town right on the border of Thrace and Macedonia. So it was like the entry point into Macedonia. And from Troas to Neapolis was a journey by ship of about 5 days, depending on weather conditions. They made it in one day. Talk about God wanting you to be somewhere. When he wants you to be somewhere, he makes it happen, but quick. On the day following, they went to Neapolis. Verse 12, and from there they went to Philippi. Neapolis was where they got back on land, and now they're on foot again. From there to Philippi, which was a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony, and we were staying in this city for some days. Now notice also what happened between the previous section and this section. Let me just go back to verse 6. They passed through the Phrygian-Galatian region. Who's writing here? Luke is the author of Acts. They passed this way. And the vision appeared to Paul in the night, and saying, come over and help us. And when he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia. Verse 10, if you want to circle the word we there, verse 10 is where Luke joins the fellowship. Luke actually became part of the team in Troas. And we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel, called us to preach the gospel to them. Therefore, putting out to sea, we ran a straight course to Samothrace. So now the author is given his first-hand journal of what happened. Okay, pretty neat. Little tidbits that we pick up from the narrative here. And on the Sabbath, they went outside the gate to a riverside. They're in Philippi. It's a major city of Macedonia. Why did they go outside the gate to a river? Isn't it Paul's practice to go into the Jewish synagogue? All you had to have in order to get a Jewish synagogue going was 10 adult Jewish males. Okay? They couldn't even put together 10 adult Jewish males in Philippi. Why is that? Well, he gives us some clues in verse 12 when he talked about Philippi, how it was a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony. this was a colony of Rome that was primarily dominated by the military. It was a Roman colony, and evidently it was not a very good place for the Jews to settle in great numbers. It was kind of a custom in the places where there was not a synagogue. They would go down to a public meeting place, usually by the river, because cities often were built on river or highway intersections. In this case, it happened to be both. Philippi was on the major road that went across the upper part of the Aegean Sea. Think of the Aegean Sea as a square here, okay? And we know that Troas was in the upper right-hand corner of the square. They sailed across to Neapolis and Philippi, which is like the middle top of the square of the Aegean Sea. And right across the top of this square, there was a major highway that ran across there. You can think of it as the interstate of that day. Okay. Philippi was on that highway. And it also had a river that ran down through it. So they would go to a major place like that, and they would have discussions and meet together. They had to go outside the gate, it says, to do that. And they went outside the gate to a riverside where they were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. That was the custom of the Jews, where there was not a synagogue. They would go outside to a place by the river where they could pray. It said they were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. He was looking for the Jews, wasn't he? He was looking for a place where the Jews would meet, where he could talk about Jesus. That was his custom. But there was no synagogue. So they sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. Mainly it was a group of women that happened to be there that day. And a certain woman named Lydia, from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics and a worshiper of God, was listening. And the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. Kind of interesting. She was from Thyatira. Thyatira is down here in the area of Asia where Paul wanted to go. The Holy Spirit wouldn't let him go there. He had to go all the way up here to Philippi to meet Lydia, who was from Asia. And she obviously was a commercial businesswoman. She had a house in Philippi where she was staying, and she was a seller of purple fabric. Purple was highly prized as a colored fabric in those days. It could be that it was manufactured in the region where she was from, in Thyatira, and she had what you might call an import-export business, and she would take it up into the Roman Empire, and she happened to be in Philippi, a Roman colony. There were some interesting adventures that happened to Paul in Philippi. Verse 16, and it happened that as we were going to the place of prayer, again, they were going back to the meeting spot, there was a certain slave girl that had a spirit of divination who met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune telling. Well, here's somebody who is under the influence of the occult, under the influence of demons. You go into the grocery store today and you see the predictions of Nostradamus and the Edgar Cayce predictions and all these other things that are on the grocery store rack or whatever. Well, this was a slave girl who was able to come up with predictions like that. And she kept crying out, saying, and listen to what she was saying, "These men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." Isn't that interesting? That's the truth. Even people that are influenced by the occult or who are under the influence of demons can speak truth sometimes. Usually, Satan and demons will twist truth to mix truth and error to try to suck you in so that you're hooked. But this girl was shouting out, proclaiming the truth, wasn't she? And she continued doing this for many days. At first, Paul might have thought, a well-known local fortune teller is actually giving us good PR. We're getting advertising time on the air, you might say, with this local gal. But Paul got annoyed, got irritated by this whole thing. I mean, he knew what was going on with this girl, didn't he? And she kept doing it for many days. And after a while, what was Paul going to do? He could leave this girl in the bondage, under oppression, under demons. Or he could say, you know what, this is getting kind of annoying. And this girl is in bad shape. What did he do? He turned and he said to the spirit, not to the girl, to the spirit, I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And came out at that very moment. So here was a case where Paul actually, under the direction of the Lord, told a demonic spirit to stop influencing this young girl. And the spirit did. The spirit left at that very moment. But when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they didn't care about that girl, did they? The masters didn't care about her as a person. All they cared about was making money off the fortune telling. When they saw that their hope of profit was gone, now these were not religious men, were they? This is not the kind of persecution that Paul had suffered in Galatia from the Jews, is it? This is commercial, economic forces that are coming to bear. They seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities, and when they had brought them to the chief magistrate, they said, these men are throwing our city into confusion, being Jews, and are proclaiming customs which it is not lawful for us to accept or to observe, being Romans. Well, there's a mistake in their charge. That is a very important mistake. He says, these men are Jews, but we are Roman citizens. The crowd rose up together against them, and the chief magistrates tore their robes off them and proceeded to order them to be beaten with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to guard them securely. And he, having received such a command, threw them into the inner prison, the most secure place they could possibly be, and fastened their feet in the stocks. But about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns of praise to God. Can you imagine being in the worst possible spot in a Roman prison? And you're all beaten and bruised and bloody. You're probably hungry and tired and upset. And what do? You burst into praise to God. So they sang hymns of praise, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there came a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison house were shaken, and immediately all the doors flung open, and everyone's chains were unfastened. Have you ever known an earthquake that would unfasten your chains? This is no ordinary earthquake, is it? And when the jailer had been roused out of sleep and had seen the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. That would have been the noble thing for him to do, would be to commit suicide, because he had not kept his responsibility, and so he was basically going to have to die. But Paul cried out with a loud voice, saying, do yourself no harm, for we are all here. Even the ones that weren't Christians were still sitting there, probably dumbfounded by all these events. And he called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. And after he brought them out, he said, sirs, what must I do to be saved? Here is a secular Roman military man who's in charge of the prison. God opened up his heart to understand the gospel. And he asked, what do I have to do? I want to be saved. And they said, believe in the Lord Jesus, and you shall be saved, you and your household. If they want to, they can be saved as well. All you have to do is what? Believe. Not be baptized, not go crawl on your knees up the steps of the most holy place, not, well, give all you have to the poor. It was all you have to do is, just like you are, warts and all, sin and all you have to do is believe that Jesus paid the penalty and died on the cross for you. That's all you have to do. Very simple gospel message, isn't it? It's not complicated. There's no works involved. Jesus did it all for us. And they spoke the word of the Lord to him together with all who were in his house. And he took them that very hour of the night and washed their wounds. He took care of them. He finally did what a decent person would have done. And immediately he was baptized, he and his all his household. And he brought them into his house and set food before them. He said, I'm going to bandage up your wounds. I'm also going to feed you, and I want you to be comfortable. And he rejoiced greatly, having believed in God with his whole household. Now when day came, the chief magistrates sent their policemen, saying, release those men. Little did they know that the men weren't even there anymore. And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, the chief magistrates have sent to release you. Now therefore, come out and go in peace. Here's where we see the effect of the mistake on the charges. But Paul said to them, they have beaten us in public without trial. Men who are Romans and have thrown us into prison. And now, are they sending us away secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and bring us out. You see, the mistake in the charge was, they didn't, Paul and Silas were Jewish, but they were Roman citizens, just like the Romans who were bringing them in before the magistrates. And you cannot beat a Roman citizen in public without a trial. You cannot throw them in jail without a trial. Paul and Silas had something going for them. They were Roman citizens. The policemen reported these words to the chief magistrates, and they were afraid. They were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. And they came and appealed to them. And when they had brought them out, they kept begging them to leave the city. And they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia. And when they saw the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. So Paul was willing to take the apology and go. He knew also that he had other places to be. It's quite possible that during that time of singing, worshiping God in song, it's quite possible that God had communicated to him what his next step was. So that was the end of chapter 16, is when Paul and Silas got out of jail in Philippi. Now, in chapter 17, we see where they went next. And across the top there of our map, we see from Philippi, they went to a place called Amphipolis, and then on to a place called Apollonia, and then on to a place called Thessalonica. So in chapter 17, verse 1, now when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. It seems like Amphipolis and Apollonia were just overnight stops. You see, they were, both of those cities were about 30 miles apart, which would have been considered a day's journey in those days. So they left Philippi, and the next day they probably spent the night at the Motel 6 in Amphipolis. And then they left the next morning and traveled on and, you know, spent the night at the Holiday Inn in Apollonia. And then finally they went their last day's journey over to Thessalonica. It seems like Thessalonica was the goal, and that the other two cities were just overnight stops on this journey. So you can see also that between Philippi and Thessalonica, it's really only about a three-day journey on the major highway, the interstate of the day, called Via Ignatia, the Ignatian Way. So about 3 days, it was about 90 miles. Now, there was a synagogue of the Jews in Thessalonica. So that tells us something about Thessalonica, doesn't it? We see in our notes here that it was a major city of the old Greek Empire. Thessalonica was named for the wife of a man named Cassander. Thessalonica was the sister of Alexander the Great, and Cassander named the city after his wife. It's been called Thessalonica, or a very close variant of that, even down to the present day. So it was a major city of the old Greek Empire, and it was independently governed. It was not a Roman colony like Philippi. Philippi had a big population of Roman military personnel, either retired legionnaires or active personnel there, but not Thessalonica. It was considered sort of an independent Greek city-state of the old world, and it was loyal to Rome, and so Rome allowed it to be self-governing. It was the largest city in all of Macedonia. So if you look in this whole orange area here of Macedonia, Thessalonica was the largest city of the whole area. It was also a major seaport. It had two things going for it. One was it was on the interstate. It was on the major highway. So overland, the trade routes could go right through Thessalonica. But also, notice, look at the gulf here of the Aegean Sea. In the upper left-hand corner of the square that forms the Aegean Sea is where Thessalonica is situated. And up in this little finger of the Aegean Sea, it was a nice, calm, deep, quiet harbor. There was a naval base there as well. So there was a lot going for Thessalonica. It had not only the crossroads of the seaport, but also the highway, so it was a great commercial center. A lot of business was being done in Thessalonica. A lot of trading was going on. And it was on the ocean, so it could catch all of the overseas trade routes as well. In fact, there were three cities in this whole area where your map is that were major cities. The first one was Thessalonica in the upper left-hand corner of our square. Now, if you go down to the lower left-hand corner, you'll see at the end of the peninsula there is a city called Corinth. Corinth was the second major seaport of that area. And if you go all the way across to the lower right-hand corner of the Aegean Sea, there's an arrow actually that goes right to it, and you can't really see all the letters, but it says Ephesus. That was the third major seaport. Between these three major cities of the region is where most of the Aegean Sea commerce was conducted. So people living in Thessalonica would have probably been very wealthy. There was probably a lot of wealth in the town. There was also a lot of old world power, because it had been a Greek self-governing city for a long time. The Jews were very numerous there. It seems like the Jews of the dispersion were very commercially savvy. They knew how to prosper economically. And so they became very influential in Thessalonica. Not only was it a wealthy commercial center, it was also a powerful administrative center, as it says in your notes. It wasn't the capital of this area, but it was so powerful and important a city that a lot of administrative functions were headquartered there. You can see why Paul probably wanted to go there. What happened to Paul when he got there? Well, according to Paul's custom, verse 2 in chapter 17, he went to them, the synagogue that is, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. He is the Messiah." You see what he was saying to them? One of the things that we've already talked about a little bit regarding the Jews of that time is that what kind of a Messiah were they looking for? In our discussion of prophecy, we know they wanted the powerful second coming Messiah, didn't they? They wanted the Messiah that the prophets wrote about, who was going to crush Israel's enemies and set up a kingdom for 1,000 years and rule on David's throne. That was the Messiah that they wanted. But what kind of a Messiah did they get? They got the Messiah that a few more obscure passages of prophecy wrote about, talking about the suffering Messiah who would come and be beaten and actually die on behalf of those he was going to redeem. So which Messiah was Paul preaching to these guys in the Jewish synagogue? The Jewish synagogue, who, by the way, were probably looking for the kingdom Messiah. Which one did he preach? Verse 3. He was explaining and giving evidence that Christ had to suffer. Which one was he talking about? The suffering Messiah. Now, he did say that this Christ would rise from the dead. And I'm sure he elaborated completely. He probably didn't leave out any details about Jesus' messiahship and his first coming. But this was the Jesus that he was proclaiming to them as being the Messiah, the suffering one. Would they have liked that? They would probably not have liked that. They wanted the kingdom Messiah. Verse 4 says, some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas. Again, some of them were persuaded. That's the remnant. The remnant is the few that you have to work with. The few who have their hearts right before God. Those are the ones you have to spend your ministry teaching and encouraging and building up in your faith. Even today, we need to work with the remnant. So, a few were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a great multitude of the God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women. Some of Paul's own kindred were persuaded, but not very many. Mainly his impact was on the God-fearing Greeks, who were Gentiles, and a number of the leading women. Leading women implies that these were the wives of some of the rulers of the city, which is quite interesting. But some of them were persuaded as well. Verse 5, here it comes. But, there's our contrast. The Jews, the non-believing Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, they went down to the bad part of town and got the most notorious ruffians they could find. They formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. They set the city in an uproar. A major city of Claudius's empire was now in an uproar.